whatever became of just plain Bill. My name is Richard Lamparski, and if you're very young, you'll probably think that was a recording of my darling Nellie Gray. But if you're as old as I am or older, it reminds you of a program that I listened to, and probably you did, for many years on the radio, for the 1930s and 1940s, long late in the afternoon on NBC or CBS, called Just Plain Bill. So by now you know my guest is Mr. Arthur Hughes, one of radio and Broadway's most distinguished character actors. Did that bring back memories, my darling Nellie Gray?
Yes, indeed. We started in 1932, and we finished in 1955. And it was a sort of a grand and glorious experience.
Just Plain Bill, I think, was one of the very earliest of the soap operas, about 32.
Yes, I believe it was, although I don't really know just when some of the soap operas started. But I would say that it was one of the first. It started for a very short time out in Chicago, and then they brought it here to New York. It was produced by Mr. and Mrs. Frank Hummert. They were great names in the radio world. Mr. Hummert was a brilliant man from the advertising field, and Mrs. Hummert was a wonderful collaborator and a great lady, and whatever they touched seemed to succeed, and they were a marvelous, marvelous team. And they had radio magic.
They had indeed, and so many of the programs, so particularly soap operas, were produced by Frank and Anne Hummert. Frank Hummert, I know, was called at one time the Saul Hurock of the radio soap operas.
Oh, yes.
Another one that they did, who has been on this program, was The Romance of Helen Trent.
Oh, yes.
Helen was here about a year or so ago. But, of course, that was a very sophisticated character, but I think if there was anything characteristic about the Hummers is that they had a real touch for small town life in the United States.
They did indeed,
particularly with Just Plain Bill. For the younger people listening in, would you tell a little bit about what Bill was? He was a small town barber.
Yes, and I would say that he was the salt of the earth. Bill was honest, and he was a man of integrity. And he looked for integrity in other people, and he generally found it. He believed in the golden rule, and the golden rule worked for him. I know that in playing Bill, I hope that a little of Bill's quality may have rubbed off on me. However, be that as it may, I enjoyed playing Bill and looked forward to each new sequence with great interest.
He had many nice qualities. I remember Bill, what was his last name?
Bill Davidson.
As a very, very decent human being. He was the variety called Ma Perkins, who I interviewed Virginia Payne about a year ago, called her just plain Bill and drag. So I guess you're Ma Perkins in Mufti.
I guess that must be it.
She was so much like him. I wonder, did you get any of those letters that she did asking for advice on personal problems?
Oh, yes, we got many, many letters.
Were you stumped?
Yes, I was stumped indeed at different times by some of their problems. But it was very heartening to have people so interested in the program and so interested in, we'll say, the story, to write letters about their own difficulties.
Along with missing Just Plain Bill as a radio program, I often think that I'd like to know someone like Ma Perkins or Bill Davidson, you know, who you could go to when you had a problem, because they were they gave very good advice and had pretty sound personal lives themselves.
Yes, I think I'd say yes to that.
Did they ever name where Just Plain Bill took place?
No, I don't think they did. I imagine that it was presumably out in the Middle West. Although, strange to say, the town of Hartville, I believe that there's a Hartville in New York State here. I think that I, at times, have gone close to it where I've seen signs saying Hartville.
Well, I'm from the Midwest, and I think many times people who are from there tend to think, oh, people behave in a particular sort of way and live particular sort of lives. But I've also spent some time upstate New York, come to think of it, in small towns. And I think really, generally speaking, small-town people are small-town people just about wherever you go, down south or up north or in the Middle West.
I would say that was right.
They're rather nice people, come to think of it. I don't think I want to live in a small town again, but they're very fine people.
Yes, indeed. It's sort of the backbone of our United States.
What was it like that last day in the studio? Very sad?
Well, not as sad as you might think, because there was a rumor going around that Bill would soon be back on the air. So we had that to buoy us up. However, the rumor turned out not to be true, and so after 20-odd years, the family had to break up. And that was a little sad.
Was Bill a widower? I don't remember a wife.
Yes, he was. He had a daughter, Nancy. And Nancy had a husband, Carrie Donovan. And that was the family, the immediate family, that you used to hear about in our stories.
Who played Nancy?
Ruth Russell. She's a fine actress.
Did she play it all the way through?
No, there were two or three others, but I'm speaking of Ruth because she played it for a very long time.
I know one of your directors who, very well-remembered name from radio, Art Hanna.
Yes, indeed, Arthur Hanna. Remember him very well, and he was a fine director. And there were several other directors. They had one woman director that we began with, Martha Atwell. And then she was with it a long time. And afterwards, we had a number of directors.
For those who don't remember what we call big radio, the golden days of radio, this might give them an idea of just how popular Hummert shows were, shows produced by Frank and Ann Hummert. Now, you must bear in mind of what the dollar meant in those days, and also that radio time is much cheaper than television time. But I don't know if you know this, Mr. Hughes, but at one time, Frank and Ann Hummert were accounted for $9 million per week in radio time. That's a lot of money even today in television, but this is radio long before inflation.
Well, they were some of the biggest names in radio. The biggest names in radio. He had, sometimes, I suppose he probably had, when I say he, I mean Mrs. Hummer too, I suppose that they had probably 20, 25, 30 programs.
Were you on NBC all the way through? I recall you.
No, we started at CBS. We were there for, I would say, 2 or 3 years. And then we came to NBC when NBC moved to the RCA building from their home that they had so long at 711 Fifth Avenue.
That was when the Rockefeller Center opened, I guess,
in the early 30s.
Then you stayed with it.
Then we stayed with it to the end.
And the time I remember, as I said at the beginning of the program for Just Plain Bill, was what I call tea time in the Midwest. It was the late afternoon, four-ish. I think you were sort of sandwiched in there between Portia Faces Life or Stella Dallas or Young Widder Brown, I think, was on there, too.
Well, we started about 6:45 to 7 o'clock, and we had that time, I would say, for a year or more, and then we switched from 7:15 to 7:30. And then they decided to send the program out to the far west, California and Washington and Oregon and so forth. And then we did two broadcasts. One broadcast was done around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, and the one to the far west was done around 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was slight changes in the time, say every couple of years, but in the main it remained pretty much the same.
Do you ever miss playing the character?
Well, yes, I do.
You kind of got in the habit, didn't you, after all those years?
I enjoyed playing Bill very, very much, and I look forward to each new sequence with great interest.
Well, it's greatly missed. I'd like to talk a bit about another radio program you were on, one of the first radio variety programs called The Collier Hour.
Oh, yes.
For the benefit of very young people, I guess they really don't even have to be very young anymore, who might not remember that there was a famous magazine called Collier's that just about everybody bought once a week.
Yes, indeed.
They were the sponsors, I expect.
Yes, they were. The Collier Hour was sponsored, of course, by the Collier Magazine. And they would take certain stories from the current issues of the magazine and make them into radio plays, and then they would be produced every Sunday night when the Collier Hour went on. One that I recall was Dr. Fu Manchu, and in this I played an Oriental part, a villain. Well, I had never had any experience with a Chinese dialect before, so I realized that I had to do some studying.
Excuse me, but did you play the title role?
The title role.
Dr.
The title
Fu
role,
Manchu.
No, the title role was the villain. Dr. Fu Manchu, he told the story.
Oh,
the
I see.
The title role was the villain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went to the International House at Columbia University, and I found a young Chinese student there that I studied with two nights a week. He taught me great deal about the Chinese dialect. And he also told me about the Chinese people and their customs and that section of the country that they came from. And we became great friends. It was very, very enjoyable. I felt like I was back in school again. And I did love it.
Did they get Dr. Fu Manchu in the last episode?
No, Dr. Fu Manchu still went on because they presumed that there would be other stories of Dr. Fu Manchu in years to come.
They presumed correctly. A very elusive character. Sex Romer, I think, wrote
that's
Fu
yes,
Manchu.
Indeed.
Oh, I loved him in the...
Yes,
in the movies.
Yeah.
Did you have an audience for that program?
Oh, yes. It was produced in the Maine at the Frolic Theater. That was on 42nd Street in the New Amsterdam Theater building. It was where Mr. Ziegfeld, the musical comedy producer and director, had some of his shows. And I remember Eddie Cantor was one of the stars that played there. Well, that was where we performed before an audience on each Sunday night that the hour went on. Then after that, quite a while after that, I was with Helen Hayes when she made her radio debut in Barry's lovely play, Dear Brutus. I remember that Charles MacArthur, Miss Hayes' husband, was around, and we were all very much interested in how the broadcast would go. Well, we didn't need to worry. It turned out fine, and everybody was happy. Then, a little later on, I was on a program with D.W. Griffith, the moving picture director who made The Birth of a Nation and many other fine films. And, of course, it was a real treat to hear Mr. Griffith talk about the early days in the films and some of some of his happenings at that time. Then I was on a special program with George M. Cohan. Mr. Cohan, of course, is a great theatrical figure here in New York. He was an actor, a director, a producer, and a playwright. And he wrote a song that was very popular during the First World War called Over There. And I imagine most people remember his 45 Minutes from Broadway. And of course, another one that I recall was Mary's a Grand Old Name. After that, I was on a program with Ethel Barrymore. Miss Barrymore, of course, was a great dramatic actress here in New York. She was the sister of John Barrymore and of Lionel Barrymore, and their father was Maurice Barrymore, and their uncle was John Drew, who was a famous star under the Charles Frohman management. Well, I played, of course, in many other radio plays and a good many, well, what would you call them? They were plays that went on from week to week. Sometimes they went on once a week. They were a little different, of course, from the soap opera that went on every day. And I think in radio experience, as I look back on it, one of the things that I do recall was that we had, when I say we, I mean the actors had usually more work than they could do. And that was a happy situation. We didn't realize it at the time. But now we do. And of course, I know that it's rather tiresome to hear about the good old days, but I wish a little of that was back with us now, and I think most actors would agree with me on that.
Mr. Hughes, you're an actor that's worked in all of the media. Do you think that any of these actresses or actors, such as Miss Hayes or George M. Cohan, did they ever have any trouble when they first went into radio with mic technique? Because it was entirely different, wasn't it?
Yes, well, I think there was a little difficulty with the mic technique, as you say, when they first started. I remember one lovely actress of years ago, Margaret Anglin, and I happened to be in the studio at the time, and I remember she was having a little difficulty because naturally she was speaking for the theater and she was speaking out and she was using a little too much voice, and her speech, perhaps you might say, it was perfect speech, but for radio it was perhaps a little too clipped. But I know they worked with her for a while and turned out all right, but it took some little time. And I think that possibly happened to other people when they first started with their radio work.
I'm talking today to Mr. Arthur Hughes, who was for so many years just plain Bill on radio. If you don't mind, Mr. Hughes, would you talk about your Broadway career for a bit? Because a lot of people, I think, you know, might think of you only as just plain Bill, and you had a very successful career on Broadway.
Well, I did. For example, I was in television for a little while. I don't know whether you'd call that Broadway or not, but would you like me to...
Yes, please.
Say anything?
Yes.
Well, in television, I was with Sir Alec Guinness when he made his TV debut in The Wicked Scheme of Jebel Deeks. Sir Alec was a very nice man, and it was a pleasure to be with him. Then a little later, I was with a play called The Silver Whistle, in which I played Mr. Beebe. This was produced by Playhouse 90, and it had been a successful play some years before. Both of these plays were directed by Mr. Franklin Schaffner, a very fine director in television. Then I was with The Night of the Storm. This was an original television play written by Mr. Horton Foote, one of our very fine writers. And it was directed by Daniel Petrie, an excellent director, who recently has made a picture called The Spy with a Cold Nose. It's very funny indeed. Well, this was a very happy engagement all around. Then I was with another English actor who has been knighted, Sir Laurence Olivier, in The Power and the Glory. And this was a very pleasant engagement indeed. And this, too, had been a play some years before on Broadway. Then I was the gambler in Big Deal in Laredo. This was the story of four big-time gamblers in a poker game with a young woman who seemingly knew very little about cards, but she ended up by winning all our money. It was a lot of fun, and the management received many letters of congratulations from the viewing public.
I saw that. As a matter of fact, it was made into a picture, which was also funny, called A Big Hand for the Little Lady,
mm-hmm.
Joanne Woodward.
Yes, yes.
Both very clever vehicles.
Yes, well, it was very, I thought, very amusing. And it was fun to be in. Well, now, about the theater. I started out when I was rather young. I was around 14, and I played in certain stock companies and repertoire companies in the Middle West. Then the war came on, and I went into the army. I went over to France in the infantry and was there for a good many months. Then the war ended, and we came back, and I was discharged, and I was sent to the American Academy for vocational training. Well, after my studies there, I started in the theater around New York. And one of the engagements I remember very well was the Theatre Guild Repertoire Company, in which I played in He Who Gets Slapped, and Shaw's The Devil's Disciple, and Ibsen's Peer Gynt, in which I had two parts, the Button Molder and Ber Griffenfeld, both fine parts which I enjoyed ever so much. Well, following this, I was with An American Tragedy. This was directed by Edward Goodman. Mr. Goodman was the founder of the Washington Square Players, out of which the Theater Guild evolved. He was also the director and the producers of the Stagers, a fine dramatic organization that flourished here in New York in the 1920s. Mr. Goodman had a wonderful understanding of acting and the problems of the actor. He would sense what was wrong with an actor's performance in rehearsal, and he would go to work with the actor and almost invariably turn in a fine performance. Mr. Goodman was very generous to a marked degree, and I think that Mr. Goodman had perhaps a better understanding of acting than the majority of people in the theater. And I know that I thought many times that Mr. Goodman's, what shall we say, his great understanding of acting helped actors immeasurably. Well, after this, I was with Harlem. Now, this was a play that had to do with the colored people. And in this, I played the detective sergeant, the only white character in the play. And this was directed by Chester Erskine, fine director and an excellent writer. The season after, Mr. Erskine directed a play called Subway Express, which was very popular at that time.
It was a murder play, as I remember.
Yes, yes, it was a murder mystery. And in this play,
they were murdering them on the subways even.
That's
then.
Right, that's right. And in this play, I was the one who committed the crime. I was the villain. Well, a little later on, I had the pleasure of being with Lynn Fontanne and Alfred Lunt in Elizabeth the Queen, which I played Sir Robert Cecil, another villain. This was written by Maxwell Anderson, one of our fine playwrights.
I think, Mr. Hughes, we should explain that the production in which you appeared in The American Tragedy was the original production from the Theodore Dreiser novel.
Yes,
because
it was.
That's been produced, I think, several times. We know it in the movies as A Place in the Sun, I think it was called.
No, this was the original production here. Well, the play, Elizabeth the Queen, was directed by Mr. Philip Muller. Mr. Muller directed many of the Gill's plays. Mr. Muller had a rapier-like sense of humor, but he was wonderfully kind, and he helped many people with their stage careers. Now, I never felt that Mr. Muller received the credit that he deserved. I think perhaps the reason for this was that he was so often overshadowed by some great star or some famous playwright. Nevertheless, his contributions to the success of the plays was of inestimable value. Well, a season after Elizabeth the Queen, Mr. Muller, with Mr. O'Neill's consent, cast me as Seth in Morning Comes Electra. And this was where I first became acquainted with Mr. O'Neill.
Now, that again was the original production of, on
this
Broadway.
This was the original
with
production.
With Alana Zimova, the Russian
That's
actress.
Right, and Alice Brady, another beautiful actress.
She was. She won an Academy Award, I think, for An Old Chicago. Fine, fine actress.
She did indeed. Well, we rehearsed this play for 7 weeks here in New York. Then we went on the road for a short time, and then we came back, and we ran for a full season here, and then later on, it went on the road again. Well, as I remember Mr. O'Neill, he was the most incandescent human being that I think I ever met. There was a burning intensity beneath his quietness. He was modest, genuine, kind, and helpful. And he showed the same consideration to a person playing a small part in his play as he did to the star. I remember the night before the opening here in New York, Mr. O'Neill came around to our dressing rooms and gave each one of us a sprig of Scotch heather as an omen of good luck. Well, the play opened, and it was a success. And shortly afterwards, Mr. O'Neill came around to our dressing rooms again and gave each one in the cast a copy of a special edition of his play with all of his working notes enclosed. It was like a gesture of gratitude for our performances. And I and everyone else felt that we should give Mr. O'Neill a gesture of gratitude for being in such a lovely play. Well, I know that distance lends enchantment, but I felt the same way about Mr. O'Neill when I first knew him, as I do now. He was a rare person indeed.
Well, I'm glad we didn't stick to just plain Bill, which was our original theme, because I think that was a very colorful career you've had.
Well, I've had my ups and downs, I guess, like most everyone else.
You enjoy the theater?
I do indeed. And I think that radio and television and the theater, they have one quality in common, and that is basically they are interested in acting in all three mediums.
Well, I know you're dying to tell how much you enjoyed my book. Don't hold back now.
Well, I don't have to hold back about that. I had your book last night, and I stayed up until past midnight looking it over, and I thought it was wonderfully interesting. And I'm sure that the great majority of people will find it the same way.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, I was just kidding, but I'm glad you did enjoy it. Anyone who would like to purchase it, it's for sale, I guess, in most bookstores by now, and also you could buy it through WBAI. If you purchase it through the station, all the proceeds go to the station. So I'd appreciate it if you sent your checks for $5.25 to WBAI, and we are at 30 East 39th Street, New York City. The zip code is 10016, and if you'd like to stop by any weekday between 10 and 6 and pick up a copy, they'll all be autographed. And as a matter of fact, very shortly I'll be having a lady in who is featured. She's given a whole segment in the book, and she's going to autograph all of her segments. A Hungarian beauty, Ilona Massey,
who
we remember from the movies. I've got another radio show coming up in the near future. A couple of people who used to appear on Gangbusters recently.
Ooh.
We also have a recording of the famous opening with the machine guns and the prisoners marching and the sirens blowing. And then from Vaudeville, Blossom Seeley.
Oh.
And from the silent movies, do you remember Priscilla Dean?
Yes, indeed.
Around the First World War. She was one of our great beauties at that time. And another figure, I guess, doesn't really fit into any of these categories, but a real coup, John T. Scopes, the central figure of the famous monkey trial from Dayton, Tennessee.
He
talked with us about, I hope, William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow. And then the last Tuesday in March, we'll be celebrating our second anniversary on the air. And I haven't firmed up exactly who's going to be on the program yet. I'll have at least three of the people who have received a lot of fan mail over the last couple of years. And as soon as I have their names, I will announce it on the program. So now while our engineer is queuing up the other theme, because Just Plain Bill was an unusual program. It had two themes. It opened, as you know, with Darling Nellie Gray, and then it closed with another one called Polly Wally Doodle. So if she has that ready, I'll tell you first about our next week's guest, who is a silent film star. She was married to Sam Warner of the motion picture Warner Brothers, and I'll be visiting with her in Bucks County, where she now has probably the world's most famous kennel of Great Dane dogs. She's a breeder. Her name is Lena Basquette, and we'll be talking about Lupe Velez and Jean Harlow and some of the other stars of the 20s and the 30s. Are we all ready with Polly Wally Doodle? Okay, our thanks to Mr. Arthur Hughes, for so many years played Just Plain Bill and was kind enough to be here with us today. This is Richard Lamparski. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you'll be with us again next week at the same time when we find out whatever became of Lena Basquette.
Whatever became of came to us recorded.